Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Robin Schulberg, and I represent Mr. George Grace. Mr. Grace was the longtime mayor of St. Gabriel, Louisiana. He was convicted of bribery based on offering to sell 17 of his privately owned lots to William Miles, a purported developer who turned out to be working for the FBI, and accepting approximately $16,000 in payments from Miles and an FBI undercover FBI agent, DJ, for promoting their garbage can cleaning service. As a result of these convictions, he received a 22-year sentence, which for all practical purposes is a life sentence for someone who is 70 years old, as is Mr. Grace. He was acquitted of what the government calls a Hurricane Katrina scheme, allegations of soliciting bribes by a witness who the jury clearly did not believe, and the city vendor scheme, where a city vendor identified absolutely nothing that Grace did to make him feel that his business was at risk if he did not give him the nominal contributions that Grace sought. I'd like first to discuss count eight. That was bribery connected with the negotiation of the real estate, the lots. Mr. Grace would never have been convicted of count eight but for the improper lay opinion testimony of William Miles. The government's sole evidence of the negotiations were these recordings, and the recordings were in plain English, clear on their face, but they didn't prove a bribe. So the government...
Mr. Grace consistently said to each of these persons acting for the government that he wasn't going to talk on the telephone because the FBI might be tapping it, don't give me money in a hallway that has a window in it, et cetera, et cetera. And I assume the district judge, Judge Hicks, felt that it was proper to allow this interpretation by Miles, if he's the one that did it.
Well, but see, Miles had no communications other than the recordings. And so
Miles could interpret, I suppose, Judge Hicks thought that perhaps Grace was engaging in his pattern of being obtuse in his responses and all to try to avoid the FBI knowing what he was doing.
I think that's circular reasoning, Judge. I mean, the judge was deciding this guy is not saying what he means, and so we need somebody to interpret what he means, and that's
funny about all the ways Grace attempted to evade the FBI knowing what he was doing. Wasn't there testimony in the record about that?
There was testimony in which he did not like to be recorded because he had been investigated before, and so he was wary of taking snatches of conversations. The point is that it was up to the jury to evaluate that testimony as it came out in the recordings. See, all the negotiations were recorded, and they were English.
Every word.
Well, exactly, Judge. And so it was up to the jury to make that decision. You can't allow a government agent to say, well, these are the inferences you should draw from plain English.
We have people all the time when they say, we'll take six crates of tomatoes, and that makes we'll take 6 kilos of cocaine.
But that's not,
what does tomatoes mean? Well, that was our word for cocaine.
But that's not what this was about.
Counsel, I understand that's not exactly what was said here. But
there were no code words.
Well, they use words like tricky business, though. And, you know, the guy sitting across the table, I don't remember if that was a phone conversation or an in-person conversation. Which was it? Was that in person?
The one, if they were sitting, you mean at the condo, at Miles' condo, that was in person, there was a video
of
that.
When you sit talking to somebody and you see their body language and you their inflection and...
But that was a video, Judge. The jury saw it, too.
Well, but don't you think the guy talking to him who has a background with him would be able to give some meaning to what the guy's saying?
But all the background was on the tapes, and the government could play whatever tapes it wants. If the government chose not to play all the tapes, then you have Miles relying on information that was not before the jury, and you're saying to the jury, well, you ought to believe him because he just knows more about this than you do.
What if, assuming that I actually agree with you that you shouldn't be able to interpret and you should just be able to repeat and they've heard the words, I still can't tell where in the record there was any harm from this, because I don't know what specific comments that were made constitute expert testimony or improper characterizations. I don't find that the brief tells me which ones are particular. It's a very lengthy examination lasting with 3 days, and most of it is him just repeating, parroting the own words, and that's not objectionable. So I don't know where you've identified what was particularly inappropriate lay witness testimony in your brief. So perhaps you could help me.
There were times when Miles said what Grace is saying is not true, assessing his credibility. There are times when he says, okay, Grace knows this.
Have you pointed to those specifically in your brief as the particular objectionable paragraphs?
Yes, I quoted the and gave the source for them. But for example, here in Exhibit 4B3, Miles complains about how you have to take care of 15 people to do business in New Orleans. Grace, you ain't got to take care of nobody around here. Prosecutor, what did you take him to mean? That's perfectly clear. You don't got to take care of nobody around here. Miles, he had just asked me to buy his property for $150,000. I didn't need to take care of nothing else, nobody else. I'm taking care of him. Now, that's very prejudicial because this was property that was worth $150,000, $170,000. Miles stood to make a profit off of it. On the tapes, Grace says, look, you build these houses and you sell them, and it's your money. And in fact, some of the properties were later sold for what Grace asked, and Grace indicated a willingness to deal. So that was extremely prejudicial, and he kept on saying things like,
did you take him to mean, which is different than what did he mean? Because his interpretation of it could be relevant to the transaction. You know, how the parties act within a transaction and what did this cause you to do? That's not an objectionable question.
It is if you're saying, here's the clear language. What did you think the clear language meant? The language speaks for itself.
It's going to require him to do something, he's allowed to say, my impression of the facts were that I needed to pay him this money and I wouldn't have to pay anybody else any money because he was going to be acting in this transaction.
But that was prejudicial because the transaction was a value for value deal. I mean, Miles kept on putting it out like, well, he just wants me to give him $150,000.
What's your best case that this is improper?
The ones I sentenced, I think, Grenage is a Freeman, Hampton, and Grenage. Is it Grenage I cited in the brief? The ones I cited, I think there were about three that I cited. Hampton, Sanchez-Sotelo, which is a Fifth Circuit case. You can't interpret plain meaning, can't go beyond the plain meaning. And the Second Circuit case, which I think is Grenage, and then more recently a Sixth Circuit case I cited in my reply brief, Freeman. Let me go on very briefly to the denial of the opportunity to cross DJ. I want to talk about in terms of count 9 of quid pro honest services fraud, sign the investor letter in exchange for paying for Felix Kabui's ticket to Uganda. Kabui was supposed to hook them up with the right people. This case was based entirely on interjections that DJ put into a conversation after Grace had already offered to, said he would sign the letter.
So is the conversation between DJ and Grace the only evidence of a quid pro quo regarding count 9?
Two conversations, one before the trip and one after. They're talking about something else, And DJ slips in, well, I guess I'll pay you because I'm a man of my word and you wrote these letters in the other, in the second one. And in the first one, they're talking about, I want you to pay for Kabui. And maybe that's where Grace was getting some advantage because Kabui would help them both in Uganda. But it had nothing to do with the investor letter. And so all you had in response, and I think this is really important, is silence on Grace's part. And that's what distinguishes from the cases that the cases in this circuit. When you have silence, you don't have the excuse that the declarant is putting the rest of the statement in context. In other words, if somebody said, if the defendant is saying something, you might need to know what the declarant said so you can understand what the defendant said. But here he said nothing at all, and so there's not this question of an integrated statement, and that distinguishes an integrated conversation. That distinguishes the Fifth Circuit cases. You could say, well, he was silent. This is the context for being silent. But when you have the conversation about something else, the inference from silence is very weak.
Is there other evidence in the record about this trip to Libya and Uganda?
Well, there's a lot about the trip, but nothing about what he was convicted of was paying.
Payment for the trip?
There was evidence.
And about signing some letter before he went on the trip?
No. The letter.
He had his executive assistant prepare it right before he left on the trip.
He had DJ raised with him before the question of paying for Kabui's ticket ever came up, I'd like you to sign this letter, blah, 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 I need it for whatever purpose. And Gray said, fine, okay? Then the next day he calls back and...
And didn't Grace sign the letter?
Grace did sign the letter, but he agreed to sign the letter before he ever raised this issue. So I don't see how...
But didn't he sign the letter after the telephone conversation saying,
yes, but
I need you to sign this before you leave?
The telephone conversation was the next day. He signed the letter about a week later before he got the money. So if he was holding the letter hostage to get the money, didn't work. The timing is a phony issue.
These were long, flowing conversations that all were somewhat related. So it seems to me like it'd be pretty difficult to pick out little snippets here and there that you're going to exclude when it's all related.
Well, the point is that there was no relationship between the letters,
statements
by DJ, which were not cross-examined. The point is there was no cross-examination.
Well, but is it hearsay when all they're talking about is the crime itself?
I think there are two ways to look at this. I'm using up all my time. Two ways to look at this. One is that it wasn't really context. The DJ statement wasn't really context, and as the case I came across, United States versus Nettles, 476 Fed 3rd, 508, 517 to 518, Seventh Circuit, that at a certain point the government can say it's context, but it's really being offered for the truth, which is there's a quid pro quo here. Not that DJ really means there's a quid pro quo, but that's what's being said. And in that situation, it is hearsay.
Your objection in district court was confrontation clause, and now your objection is due process.
The theory...
I understand you claim that's one and the same, but in district court, didn't you say confrontation, and here you're saying due process?
Correct, but in district court and here, we were saying failure to cross-examine. You don't have to say which constitutional amendment it comes under. But in any event, if you take the approach, United States versus ACPEN, and the court said that with Booker, is right to cross-examine. The reason I went to due process is I was looking at it as you got a statement here by DJ, you got silence by George Grace, and the issue is what is this thing in between that links them? What is the circumstances? And that didn't seem to fit neatly into confrontation. If you take it, the argument in district court was this isn't really context, this is hearsay, it's for the truth of the matter asserted, and that would make it a confrontation problem. But over and over again, the emphasis was on right to cross-examination. Very 15 seconds on the sentence, grossly disproportionate to someone like Bill Jefferson. The judge said different scale. Bill Jefferson only got 13 years, Grace got 22. The judge says, I'm not going to give you a life sentence that the guideline mandates, and then he functionally gives him a life sentence. And I see my red light is on, but I've reserved some time for just a rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Amundson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Corey Amundson on behalf of the United States. I'd like to begin by addressing Your Honor's questions about the other evidence aside from the...
Before you get to that, just following up on this sentencing question, subsequent to the start of the briefing in this case, our court handed down the opinion in Nelson, one of these mayors that was involved in all of this, and our court permitted a supplemental brief on loss calculation by Grace. The government brief at page 6, note 3, refers to the Nelson case and said it would file a supplement, a response to this, file a supplement on this. I don't see one in the record. Did the government ever file a supplement?
Your Honor, what we were referring to in that particular footnote was our opposition to the supplemental memo that our opposition to file the supplemental memo that the defendant filed in that case.
I thought the supplemental brief was filed before the government's reply brief.
It was, Your Honor. It was filed before our response brief. The reference in the footnote, I don't recall it off the top of my head, but the reference intended to be a reference to our opposition to the filing of the supplemental, in which we talked substantively about the issues raised in the supplemental.
So the government has never addressed the Nelson case other than a reference in the footnote?
Other than the reference in the footnote and our opposition to the filing of the supplemental.
How do you distinguish this case from Nelson?
I don't think you can, Your Honor. I think, in all candor on the facts, the issues raised in the Nelson case on the sentencing are one of the same as the issues raised in sentencing here. And so, in our opposition to the supplemental, we don't take issue with whether or not it's error in that respect.
So we should remand for resentencing to use the $8,000 instead of the $2 million?
I don't believe that's necessary, Your Honor. And the reason I don't believe it's necessary is that the recalculation based on the Nelson case results in the exact same offense level, namely offense level 43.
Regardless of whether you use $2 million or $8,000, it results in the same offense level?
The district court concluded that the total value of the robbery involved in the entire case was over $9 million. The contested valuation concerns $6 million of value. If you take that away, which is what the Nelson case conceitedly would have you do, you are left with a $3 million valuation. The difference in the enhancements under the guidelines is a difference of two levels.
And I thought the value in Nelson was the amount the defendant actually received.
With respect to the bribes at issue and that are conceitedly at issue in this case on the investor letter and the EPA letter. However, the difference, Your Honor, is that in this case we have not just one scheme, the Cypher scheme, but we have four separate schemes. The Katrina fraud scheme, the city vendor scheme, a real estate scheme, and the Cypher scheme.
The ones that he was acquitted of?
Two of them are ones right. That he was arguably acquitted of. Yes, Your Honor.
So you're trying to add those on to say we don't have to remand here?
Well, that's the district court calculated right. The total amount of the total value of the bribery based on not only the convicted counts, but as well as those acquitted counts for which they found preponderance of the evidence that there was sufficient evidence to determine that as relevant conduct.
In abundance of caution, wouldn't it be appropriate for the district court to get a chance to look at this again in light of our ruling in Nelson?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think so, and the reason I don't think so is the calculation would be the same. In other words, you get to the exact same offense level.
But you haven't argued that in any brief to us.
Yes, Your Honor, I did. In the opposition to the supplemental brief.
That's it, yeah.
And then in the footnote in the brief, yes.
The footnote.
Why couldn't the district court say, I'm going to, the appropriate amount here under Nelson is the amount the defendant allegedly or was convicted of receiving and not the amount involved in the scam?
Well, certainly the district court could do that, and based on Nelson and these set of facts, would do that on the on a remand, or would do that if they had understood Nelson was coming. The point only is that, Your Honor, had they done that, the offense level would be no different than it is today.
He didn't receive $3 million. There's no allegation that Grace received $3 million.
Not with respect to the Cypher scheme. However, with respect to
the scheme,
the Hurricane Katrina scheme, Your Honor, the allegation is that Mary Grace intended to receive and solicited a bribe that was worth $1.6 million. Okay. And that was with respect to a FEMA contract.
But how do we get to $3 million? If you get $1.6 million on Katrina and you get $8,000 here, how do we get to $3
million? We have $1.6 million on the Katrina fraud. We have $900,000 in connection with the real estate scheme, which involved false official letters.
That he was supposed to receive, not the amount involved in the scheme, but that he was personally going to receive under Nelson.
In that particular instance, the $900,000 was a value that would have gone to the Cypher, but that was the value that the district court determined to be the appropriate value of that bribe.
Right, but now so the value of that bribe, that's not money that he would receive.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, the court should reevaluate that one under Nelson, too.
Your Honor, I don't believe Nelson goes that far. Nelson, I don't believe, restricts the district court to only looking at the value of the bribery based on what the defendant actually received. The law, I believe, is still very much the case where it's either the greater of the value of the money he actually received or intended to receive, the value of the loss involved, to the government, whoever else, and whatever the greater of those numbers are. And in this case, the district court, Judge Hicks, determined each of those different valuations with respect to each of the different bribes at issue and came up with the figure that he came up with, which was north of $9 million. If you take away the bribes that were at issue at Nelson, the $6 million, you are left with a $3 million valuation.
You know, I hadn't read Nelson in the last few days, but I thought what the hell was it? Since we can't tell how much the loss would have been without the letter, the difference between what the loss would have been without the letter and with the letter, we can't evaluate the loss that's caused by the fraud. So we're going to go to what the defendant received.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what you tell me about the real estate transaction, why wouldn't that same thing apply here?
Well, Your Honor, with respect, first of all, the real estate transaction, of course, was not at issue at all in Nelson. That was a completely different scheme that was unique to Grace. But the reason it's not, it doesn't lend itself to the Nelson analysis is because in the real estate scheme, for example, the district court was attempting to determine, first of all, what was the valuation of the bribe solicitation that the defendant made in asking that Mr. Miles purchased $170,000 worth of his property. That was one aspect of it. Another aspect of it was to determine what the value is of different official letters that the defendant sought from Mr. Miles to send to banks in order to secure a loan fraudulently. That was another part of the valuation. And that those different valuations were very different transactions than the kind of transactions at Nelson. Nelson was concerned about determining whether or not there was a linkage and a causation between the two things and what would have happened but for the letters. As I understand, Nelson was one of the issues. The other issue being what would have happened had the fraudulent letter in that case not been sent, would the grant have still been given in the amount suggested?
I'm still $492,000 short. Can you help me? You've got 1.6 Katrina and 8,000 here, and then assuming you're 900,000, I'm still short. Maybe my math is bad or I'm missing something, so I need you to help me.
Certainly, Your Honor, and I'll do the best I can. I don't have it all right in front of me, but another aspect of the valuation was the value of the Cypher contracts that the defendant was assisting in trying to get. That was part of the valuation. Another part of the valuation was
And that gets up to $492,000? You got to get to $3 million. I don't understand why there wasn't briefing that was more thorough in this as just a footnote in this.
Your Honor, I apologize.
Because we're not to $3 million, and you can't really, you're kind of loosey-goosey, but we're supposed to take your word that it goes to $3 million, and so we don't need to do anything here.
Well, Your Honor, I certainly don't mean to suggest you should take my word for it.
Your word is good. I mean, I'm not criticizing your word in any way, but it would be good to have it all spelled out for us.
I understand, Your Honor, and my apologies to the court for that. I certainly did not mean to short shrift the issue at all in responding initially to the motion itself. In our view, it had been an issue about conceding error and showing the court why it wasn't an error. The idea of filing an additional opposition, having not had authority to do that, we certainly could have requested that. I'm not suggesting we couldn't, but that's where we are today. With respect to the calculation that Your Honor suggested, I don't think that even defense counsel and in their briefs hasn't suggested that the calculation would be any different than the $3 million we're suggesting. In fact, in response to the opposition that we did file to their filing in the supplemental, they acknowledged that the district court had determined the original valuation to be a little north of $9 million, which is reflected in the statement of reasons, and that the valuation they are challenging is the $6 million in valuation reflected with respect to the EPA letter and the CIFRA letter. Taking away that $6 million leaves you with the $3 million, and the $3 million results in an enhancement that drops by two levels. And by only dropping two levels, since the district court originally calculated the offense level to be a 46, it drops you down to a 44, and then, of course, the district court went ultimately reformed to a 43, which is at the top of the range, which would be reformed to as well, even with the adjustment for Nelson. And so that's the analysis that we went through, and that's the reason I believe that even though there is conceivably error with respect to Nelson, that it is harmless error.
And Nelson, of course, was just one of the, I'll use the word, minor players in this. And as I understand it, Grace was referred to as the godfather. Does the fact that Grace was on top of all of these schemes overarching, does that distinguish it from Nelson? I know you said you can't distinguish this from Nelson, but what about the fact that Grace was the main man in charge and Nelson was just one of his helpers?
Your Honor, you're exactly right. Grace was the main leader in all of these different schemes. One of the big things that makes him different than Nelson, overarching-wise, is that the Nelson case involved one scheme, the CIFRA scheme. Mayor Grace's case involved four different schemes, as well as a number of other pieces of conduct that were admitted as part of both 404B and impeachment concerning a number of different bribery schemes he was involved in. And so in that respect, the difference between the two men, and in particular their sentences, is well justified. With respect to the calculation of the loss value, the bribe value on the EPA letter in the Nelson case and the EPA letter in this case, and then the investor letter in this case and the investor letter in that case, conceivably, again, I cannot, there are some factual differences between those two things, but I do not suggest to Your Honor that there are factual differences that make a consequence. And we would concede that it is error under Nelson. But again, we would go back to the notion that it's harmless and we get to the same range. But in terms of evaluating this defendant as to other defendants, whether it be Mr. Nelson or any other defendants around the country in their sentencing, Mr. Grace's conduct over 30 years, I'd suggest, Your Honor, and conduct in all the different charges that were contained in the indictment, as well as the other conduct shown throughout the trial, reflect a defendant who committed these crimes over the course of his entire career and is quite an outlier in terms of public corruption, even in our state. As Judge Hicks mentioned and as he pointed out various times, it was clear to him that one of the things Mayor Grace stood prepared to do and actually took steps to do, and but for it being an FBI undercover operation may have well done, was solicit the state legislature to try to pass legislation mandating trash can cleaning for all municipalities in the state, thus, of course, being a complete boon to the cipher and himself. And it's that kind of action in his official capacity as mayor that he was willing to take. He was willing essentially to do anything. And as Your Honor pointed out, that status of godfather illustrates that his influence as mayor was quite significant, particularly among his fellow mayors for whom he did take bribes to influence, as Your Honor is aware. With respect to the issues raised with Mr. McAllister in his testimony, there was a question regarding the other evidence that exists apart from his those recordings, and of course there's abundance of that evidence. The letter involved, the so-called investor letter as to that issue, was a letter that Mayor Gray sent out believing on city letterhead, believing that this was going to be used to raise funds with investors. And he deliberately and admitted on cross-examination that the letter was a lie, that he actually changed parts of the letter before he sent it out to make it even more of a lie, and that he sent it out only after DJ, Mr. McAllister, confirmed to him that he would pay for his plane ticket as well as his associate's plane ticket, which resulted in a figure of $20,000. It was only after that agreement that he got him the letter. In fact, he said, well, I'm sure once you, there was a conversation where Mr. McAllister is assuring him that he'll get with him the next day about the tickets, and the response by the defendant is, well, by then I'll get you the letter. These circumstances, the circumstances of the payment and the circumstances of the letter and the conversations apart from those being contested, show you a context that standing alone, I would suggest to you, is more than sufficient for any jury to conclude that this was bribery activity, particularly when it's in the context of Mr. McAllister and Mr. Miles only having one relationship with the defendant and that relationship being a corrupt one. There was no outside relationship that these men had with each other apart from this corrupt activity.
What about as to count eight, the city property? What other evidence was there of fraud?
With respect to count eight, Your Honor?
Yeah.
And count eight is the real estate scheme, and that's the challenge with respect to the lay opinion testimony. On that, Your Honor, Judge Hicks, I think, hit it on the head, which is that this was a savvy defendant who really went out of his way to try to lay down false exculpatories, believing that he was under surveillance at various times by the FBI, stating in some instances that he was aware that he didn't want to talk in his vehicle because that's where they got Congressman Jefferson, that he used to meet with Governor Edwards in the steam room where they all got naked and discussed their business. This was somebody very cognizant of that. And the great example of that cognizance came in a video recording in which the defendant is speaking about getting Mr. Miles a minority interest in a casino truck stop if he comes through for him on his personal land deal. And while he's talking about that, he says, you know, I don't have any interest in this truck stop. I don't have. And meanwhile, he's hitting Mr. Miles and going back and forth with him. And he later explains and actually articulates what he meant by that. He explained that he was talking sign language and that this means me and you. And so even though the words out of his mouth were, I don't have anything to do with this, this is not my interest, he's using sign language to indicate that they're going to have an interest among themselves. They're going to
split. Video?
It was, Your Honor. And then later, the explanation of what that meant was on audio tape. And then before that, there was an instance on the audio tape where you heard Mr. Miles talking about the same thing, the video poker deal, and Mr. Grace again saying, I have no interest, and Mr. Miles saying, why do you keep hitting me in the arm? Why do you keep hitting me in the arm? And Mr. Grace saying, and I'll excuse the language, stop saying that, MF, you know, I'm talking sign language. Again, another indicator that what he says out of his mouth is not necessarily what he means.
I've got a couple quick questions.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it counts 9 and 11 and 13 that would be influenced if we believe that the Valdez interpretation of Birdsall is correct? What counts are affected if we think that it was overbroad and under as the Valdez in the D.C. Circuit is defined by Birdsall? I'm just trying to figure out if we were to think that they were correct on that argument, what counts are affected?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's with respect, as I appreciate it, to the official act instruction that the defendant has challenged. The defendant has challenged that instruction only with respect to count 13.
So 13 is the only count that it matters, and if we were to follow Valdez in the D.C. Circuit, there would be error, correct?
I don't know that that's correct, Your Honor. Valdez involved a much different set of circumstances. That case involved, of course, police officers using NCIC essentially for personal business. And in this case, Your Honor, the what you have is the use of official influence in somebody's official capacity. And the way I think about it is if, in fact, the use of your official influence in your official capacity is not covered by the bribery statute. You could have a federal prosecutor like myself take a bribe in order to call my counterpart in the state to say, hey, you really need to dismiss charges on John Doe.
So you think it's factually distinguishable and we don't have to vacate because even if we were to choose Valdez in some other context. I'm sorry, I've got one other question. When did the government know that the witness would not testify and plead the fifth? It seems like the exhibit, it was pre-admitted, and then all of a sudden the person's not going to testify, and it puts the defense at a real disadvantage. And it seems to be, you know, there's some level of it seems to be unfair that you're not going to be able to cross-examine a key witness that you've already heard the tapes of. And if the government knew about that ahead of time and didn't tell everybody, that makes me uncomfortable.
We've all known about that for quite some time, Your
so
Honor.
They were agreed, pre-admitted. It was agreed to pre-admit these tapes, even knowing ahead of time on both sides that the witness would not testify.
That's correct, Your Honor.
They agreed to admit the tapes.
Yes, Your Honor. And that was an issue of authenticity. And quite frankly, the case law is such that authenticating tapes can be done without the presence of in this instance, the confidential.
So before the person testified, the defense didn't say, I mean, before the tapes were played, the defense didn't say this is a violation of due process or confrontation or any of that before the tape was originally played.
You know, they did. They certainly said it was a violation of confrontation at various points along the way. And what they did, what I'm just suggesting, Your Honor, is the authenticity of the tapes was not challenged.
No, but I'm.
And so it was put into evidence.
We're constitutional issues is what we're dealing with here.
Yes.
So they weren't blindsided.
Oh, no.
And they chose not to address due process at the time that they were first played.
Correct. They did. They definitely challenged on confrontation clause grounds, which we addressed. But they did not challenge on what I perceived to be this other issue of right to defense under due process clause.
Do you believe confrontation is present with us for this appeal, or do you think that's been abandoned?
You know, I don't know about that, Your Honor. I think the fact of the matter is the issue is relatively straightforward in the sense that these tapes were all admitted for context. None of the statements were in fact true. I mean, not only were we not suggesting that they be admitted for the truth of the matter, they weren't true. It was all an undercover operation. Most of the statements weren't true. And so the whole notion that there is any confrontation issue at all, I think, becomes eviscerated by that fact that none of this stuff was true to begin with. And Judge Hicks very diligently instructed the jury on multiple occasions that these were only, Mr. McAllister's statements were only being admitted for the truth of the matter asserted, for context, not for the truth of the matter asserted. And for that reason, Your Honor, however, I think you look at that particular issue, whether it's through the lens of the confrontation clause or the lens of due process, the result's the same, which is that these were properly admitted, and they were properly admitted for context, and that was explained clearly to the jury, which, by the way, the jury was very careful in looking at these different counts by virtue of looking at the verdict. Many of the counts that were acquittals were based on a lot of D.J. statements.
And I red line.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much. All right, Ms. Shelburne, back to you.
Thank you, Judge. I'd like to discuss the sentence and the basis for the loss calculation, the government's, the $9.4 million. $1.2 million of that was based solely on the testimony of Luis Gonzalez, the person who claimed that involved in the Hurricane Katrina scheme, who claimed that Gray solicited this money. The jury acquitted on those counts, and his testimony was the only evidence of a solicitation. Now, if the jury acquitted, it meant they didn't believe him. That is a different kind of acquitted conduct issue than the kind this court usually faces, because you've got the jury says we don't believe you, the judge says I do believe him, who prevails?
I know you're not implying we don't know this, but the jury, of course, has beyond a reasonable doubt, and the judge just has a preponderance. That's a huge difference.
Well, yes, but when it's a question, do you believe the witness or not, it's a yes or a no. That's different than when you're talking about little bits of evidence. On the that was where $1.2 million came in. The city vendor scheme, that was $450,000 based on the value of the city contract to maintain and repair heavy equipment. Again, an acquittal. And there was And as I said, that was based on Efferson never identifying what it is Grace did to intimidate him, and there was evidence that there was no other dealer to maintain and repair the city equipment that the city could go to without losing a warranty. So that figure, I think, has no validity. The real estate scheme, $45,000 based on the reduction of the price of the 90 lots from $7,500 to $7,000. Well, the lots eventually sold to another developer for $7,000. So I don't see how there's any wrongdoing involved in that, any harm. $900,000 was the amount of financing Miles sought in connection with the letter of support that Grace wrote to him to show that he was going to use for the bank to get financing. All of that money was supposed to go into developing the properties. We would say there'd be no loss under Nelson. Grace was not going to get any of that. It was all going to develop the property, the intended use. Cipher, $829,000 expected profit from the Cipher contracts with the municipalities whose mayors were involved. Grace did not request, never asked for a percentage of the profits the other mayors did, including Nelson. And that's one ways that I think they were like the young bears taking down the old one. Also, Nelson, by the way, took over on the state legislature side. It's unclear Grace ever did anything. Nelson took over on that and ran with it. So $829,000 expected profit, none of which would go to Grace, and then the investor letter and the EPA letter, $3 million apiece. So that's where the breakdown occurs, and it's on page 5 of the government sentencing memorandum to the court. Let me see. 1 minute. I guess if the court has no questions, that's basically all I have. We ask that you reverse the set aside counts 1, 8, 9, 11, and 13, and you vacate the sentence, remand for resentencing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We have your case.